Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, beer. What's good, what's not? From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, beer. What's good, what's not, and what's what? We'll talk with one of the world's leading experts on beer, Michael Jackson. He'll tell us how beer is brewed and what makes a beer good. He'll rate some of America's best-known brands and tell us about the renaissance of regional microbreweries. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A dozen large wildfires are sweeping across dozens of acres of Southern California, driven by dry winds that gusted as high as 70 miles an hour. Officials say the fires have burned more than 45,000 acres and destroyed hundreds of houses. At least 11 people have been injured fighting the fires. President Clinton delivered his health care reform legislation to Congress today. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The President and First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton delivered the 1,350-page bill that will form the basis of the debate over health care reform. The President said he wanted to maintain a spirit of bipartisanship as the debate begins. He said he had no pride of authorship and was open to proposals that would modify the details of his bill, but not the main goals.
When it is over, we must have achieved comprehensive health care security for all Americans, or the endeavor will not have been worth the effort. That is what we owe the American people.
The president's program envisions universal coverage by the beginning of 1998, a slightly slower phase-in than he had originally proposed. And the president has capped the amount of federal subsidies for small businesses and low-income individuals at $161 billion over 5 years, unless Congress approves more money. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
A bipartisan group of House members has proposed more than $100 billion in additional budget cuts. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The White House yesterday presented a $10 billion package of further cuts, part of a promise it made to get votes last summer for the president's deficit reduction plan. But a bipartisan House task force has come up with a much larger proposal that includes reductions in the federal workforce, a symbolic freeze in congressional pay, and limits on Medicare benefits to some elderly Americans. Republican John Kasich of Ohio is co-chairman of the group and is optimistic about the plan's chances.
We think it's very possible that we will, in fact, see a $100 billion spending cut package enacted in the Congress, started by a group of Republicans and Democrats who together share deep concern about the United States.
The proposal was drawn up by 25 House members, many of them freshmen. It will come up for a vote next month. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Texas prosecutors have resumed their efforts to indict Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison on ethics charges. One of Hutchison's former aides has been granted immunity in exchange for her testimony before a grand jury. Hutchison is accused of misusing her office when she was the Texas state treasurer and destroying records to cover up the misconduct. An earlier indictment of Hutchison was dismissed because one of the grand jurors was ineligible to serve. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points to close at 3,664.7. This is NPR News. The U.S. Coast Guard returned 15 would-be refugees to Haiti today. The refugees were intercepted yesterday in a 20-foot sailboat off Haiti's northwest coast. An embassy spokesman told reporters that the repatriation went smoothly. He didn't reply when asked if it was hypocritical for the United States to send Haitians back to a place that's viewed as unsafe for Americans. Eyewitness reports from the Central African state of Burundi say thousands of people have been killed and large areas of the countryside are in flames in violence arising from last week's military coup. The coup was organized by members of the minority Tutsi people who've ruled over the majority Hutu people for generations. The BBC's Mark Doyle has flown over the area by helicopter. He filed this report.
An entire valley in the district of Vumi is a swirling mass of smoke. Hundreds of houses and farms are ablaze. It's a fair guess that there were dead in every hamlet in this area. The town of Buyiga is littered with bodies. The only sign of life in Buyiga, normally a town of perhaps 3,000 people, was behind the walls of the local government compound where refugees had gathered for protection. At another government compound in the central town of Karuzi, I asked 6 people at random how many of their close friends and family had been killed. The total came to more than 60. Thousands have been killed in Burundi. The countryside is in ruins. The Tutsi population has paid a terrible price for the coup against a Hutu president. Many Hutus have died as well. Neither community will forget.
The BBC's Mark Doyle. There was another sign today that the big Disney theme park in France isn't doing well. British Airways says it has stopped selling tours to the Euro Disney park because there just isn't enough demand. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Beer doesn't taste quite the same after hearing beer expert Michael Jackson. Bad beer tastes worse. Good beer tastes better. Jackson was a newspaper journalist when he realized his fellow journalists drank beer, talked beer, but wrote columns about wine. Jackson decided it was time to give beer its due. He's the author of several books about beer. His new book, Michael Jackson's Beer Companion, covers beers and brewing styles from around the world. Jackson's work has paralleled the renaissance of regional microbreweries. There's a story about one of those breweries, Anchor Steam in San Francisco, that foreshadows the beer renaissance. The brewery was about to close in 1965 when it was taken over by somebody whose last name you'll recognize.
A man called Fritz Maytag, who's actually a member of the washing machine family, was at that time studying literature at Stanford in Northern California, just on the peninsula south of San Francisco. And he used to hang out in San Francisco in a bar called the Spaghetti Factory. And he used to drink a beer called Anchor Steam, which had been made since the 1890s in San Francisco. And one day the bartender said, "Well, I'm sorry, this is going to be the last one you're going to have, Fritz." And Fritz said, "Well, why on earth should that be so?" And he said, "Well, I'm afraid the brewery's closing at the weekend." And Fritz went down to the brewery with just the intention of seeing whether he could offer any assistance. He didn't plan to buy the brewery, but over a period of years he finished up buying it. And really, the Anchor Steam Brewery is a Rolls Royce of small breweries in America. It's become very famous for its Anchor Steam beer, which is the only beer of a style that totally originated in America. It's a curious hybrid between a lager and an ale. It's a type of beer that was made in a very improvised way during the gold rush in California. And Fritz and his Anchor Brewery have continued to make the beer in that way, albeit with rather better equipment. And they also make a porter and a wonderfully hoppy ale, which has really, in a way, given rise to a new style of ale on the West Coast, and a barley wine. And that brewery, Fritz was, in the language of psychology, Fritz was a sort of enabler for this movement.
Does Anchor Steam have a special steam process? What does the steam mean?
The name Steam is purported to come from the fact that this type of beer was made during the gold rush in the 1890s, when there was no artificial refrigeration available there. And it therefore fermented very, very wildly, and It was said that when you tapped a cask, the great hiss of CO2 coming out resembled steam.
Now, you're very enthusiastic about regional beers made by microbreweries. What's the difference between beers that are made in large commercial breweries and those that are made in the smaller breweries?
Well, most of the beers that are made in large commercial breweries at the moment are extremely bland in flavor. I mean, they're the sort of beer equivalent to Wonder Bread or Kraft cheese slices or something like that, processed cheese. They're very bland, and they're made to be all things to all men, and of course, as a result of that, they're nothing much to anybody. Now, that's not to say that the big brewers don't make any good beers. I mean, if you take a brewery like Coors, which its regular beer is very light-tasting indeed, but it does make a wintertime beer called Winterfest that's absolutely full of character and is a wonderful beer, and Coors has announced that it's going to make a wheat beer and it's going to make a Bock beer in the future. Miller, I think a very interesting happening this year, very recently, was that Miller, which is the second biggest brewer in America, they launched two new products. And one was clear beer, which looks like soda and tastes like soda, but has alcohol in it. I think that's very misleading apart from anything else. But why on earth would you want to take the color out of beer when the color of beer is so attractive? But anyway, Miller decided to launch something called clear beer, which was really the ultimate in tasteless, unbeer-like beer. And at the same time, they launched a product called Miller Amber Ale, and they went to Britain and found a British ale yeast and made a really good product. The interesting thing is that they've pulled the clear beer off the market because it didn't sell, and they're doing quite well with Miller Amber Ale. So the big brewers can make every bit as interesting beer as a small brewer can. The question is whether they actually have the will to make it. There are some technical problems that although they've got all the technical skills to do it, often their equipment is just too big. Their brew kettles are too big to make products that will sell in, you know, relatively small quantities to a sort of educated minority, if you like. And psychologically, they're very geared to high volume and mass marketing, and they do find it difficult psychologically to deal with smaller products. But I think we will see more of them. I think we'll see the big brewers making more of these specialty products. It's also true that not every small brewer makes interesting beer. I mean, you can start a small brewery and just make boring beer, but you won't be in business for very long if you do that, because there's plenty of boring beer out there already. The only point in starting a new small brewery is if you're going to make something different, and most of them do.
Two of the words to know if you're looking for regional beers are brew pub and microbrewery. What's the difference between the two?
A brew pub is a pub or restaurant that makes its own beer on the premises and generally doesn't sell its beer anywhere else. It maybe perhaps does sell it to a couple of local bars, but most of them actually, most brew pubs, their products are available only on their own premises. There's a very famous one in New York called the Manhattan Brewing Company. There's another one in New York called Zip City. There's a famous one in Philadelphia called Dock Street. I won't go on because there are about 200 to 250 of these brew pubs all over the country, ranging right across. I was just giving some examples from the Northeast. There's the Old Columbia Brewing Company in San Diego, California, for example, at the opposite corner. There are a huge number of them in the Seattle region in the Northwest. Big Time in Seattle is one of my great favorites. So those are the brew pubs, but a microbrewery is just a very, very small local or regional brewery, but it doesn't have a pub attached. It sells beer in the normal way to local pubs and restaurants and stores. And there are maybe 50 or 100 of those, too.
And the funny thing is that some of the big commercial breweries closed down while these new breweries started flourishing.
Well, I think the tough place is being in the middle. If you're going to be in the brewing business, you need to be huge or tiny, but not in the middle.
What are some of the ones in the middle that shut down?
Well, some of them, there are some that have not shut down, but that have had considerable difficulties. I mean, even at the bigger end, companies like Stroh's and Pabst, which were once widely known national brewers, are not as widely known as they are anymore. In the middle, there was a wonderful brewery in Philadelphia called Schmitz, which had wooden vessels that were the height of the ceiling. It was just a magnificent late 1800s brewery, and that closed down in the last 10 years. And there have been several like that. The famous old Grain Belt Brewery in Minneapolis, the building still stands, and it's a magnificent Victorian building with all of its windows broken out by vandals or weather. It stands there like a sort of toothless face, or looking at the city in terrible, terrible reproach for the city's failure to support its beers.
My guest is Michael Jackson. He's written a new book called Michael Jackson's Beer Companion. In talking about where the breweries are, you say that beer used to be made in a lot of Christian abbeys after the Dark Ages. Now, that seems almost contradictory with wine. You know, if an abbey's making wine, you could say, well, the wine is a sacramental drink. But with beer, it's harder to put the two together.
I've never really understood, when people ask me this question, I've never understood why they're surprised about abbeys and Christian brothers making beer. It seems odd that people are surprised at that. And the whole notion that there's anything wrong with drinking alcohol is a very recent notion. It really dates back to the late 1800s. And it's very much a Protestant notion and doesn't apply at all in Catholic countries. The reason that either wine or beer was made in abbeys was that the first monastery, as we understand monasteries, was in the 5th century. It was formed by Saint Benedict in the south of Italy at Monte Cassino, and he set out rules by which the brothers should live, and one of these rules was that they should live by the work of their own hands. They should support themselves, and that was an agricultural area, and they grew grapes, so they made wines. And of course the first travellers really were pilgrims, so they had to stay somewhere on their pilgrimages, and they would stay at an abbey. An abbey would be an hotel, would be one of its functions. And abbeys were also, of course, the centres of learning. So a lot of early winemaking and brewing science was developed by monks. As soon as the monastic movement spread beyond Italy, insofar as it spread in a northerly direction into Austria and Germany, particularly to Bavaria, which was the next bit of Germany, the monks there, they couldn't grow grapes. It was too cold. They could grow grain. So instead of making beer for there to earn money to support the abbey, instead of making wine to make money to support the abbey and to provide something for their guests at the table, they made beer. And there are still about 6 monastic breweries and 2 convent breweries in Bavaria. And there are, actually I missed out as well, as one in Austria. In Belgium, there are 5 Trappist monastery breweries, and there's a 6th one in the Netherlands. And because the Trappists are the most strict of all of the religious orders, and the most contained and the most private, perhaps that's why they have maintained their brewing traditions most strongly, and the beers made in the Trappist monasteries are a very, very distinct style of beer.
Tasty?
Well, very, very full of flavour. They vary from, among those that you can buy in the United States, they vary from the very intensely dry, hoppy Orval beer, which is made at the monastery of Orval in Belgian Luxembourg, to the much richer, sweeter, more spicy Chimay beers, especially one called Chimay Grand Reserve. And in Belgium, but you can't get it here, a wonderfully citric, spicy, pale-coloured beer called Westmalle Triple. But there's a whole range of them, and you know, they're a very important part of the gastronomy of beer, if you like.
Why do so many beer styles originate from Central and Western Europe?
Well, if you think of, I mean, the history of brewing is 5,000 years at least. Beer may have been the beginning of civilization, and it was certainly made in the earliest civilizations in Mesopotamia. It began to spread westwards just as the cultivation of grain and civilization began to spread westwards into places like the former Soviet countries, like Armenia, for example, especially Armenia. And then somehow the Dark Ages, the time of the Vandals and the Goths and so forth, descended upon us, and we re-emerge in the medieval period with the monks of Munich and Bavaria and Belgium, and those countries where the climate favours grains like barley, which are the basic the source of fermentable sugars in beer, and they're also the countries where the climate favours hops, which are the seasoning, the condiment, the herbs and spices in beer. So as medieval times turned into modern times, both wine and beer came into the forms that we now understand in that part of Europe, with really the wines being made in slightly to the south in Italy, France and Spain, and beer's being made slightly to the north in what is now the Czech Republic, Germany, Belgium, Britain and Ireland. And from all of those regions, people emigrated to the United States from the earliest days of colonial settlement, and especially in the hungry 40s, in the 1840s, when they came to the Midwest and the Great Lakes states and brought all those traditions here with them. There was that tremendous variety of beer in the United States before Prohibition. I mean, every ethnic group who came here brought their own type of beer with them. There were hundreds of breweries in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and also in Wisconsin particularly, making German-style wheat beers, for example. And all of that really ended with Prohibition. I mean, all those little guys, all like Ma and Pa breweries, just like a Ma and Pa baker's shop, they all went out of business at the time of Prohibition and never came back. So what's happening now, this great surge, these hundreds of new breweries that are opening up all over the country, are really rediscovering something that was here before Prohibition.
Michael Jackson will be back with us in the second half of our show. His new book is called Michael Jackson's Beer Companion. This is Fresh Air. I'd like to propose a toast, but I don't have a glass of beer, and you probably don't either, so I have something else to propose. I suggest you call and make a pledge. That may strike you as a self-serving proposition, but it isn't really, not if you enjoy Fresh Air. Let me explain. It costs money for your station to acquire our program. That acquisition fee becomes an essential part of our production budget. The point is, without your pledge, your station couldn't afford to bring you Fresh Air, and you wouldn't be able to listen to it. I hope you'll call with a pledge. Thank you very much. This week, we're featuring a series of concert excerpts from our archives. Last fall, we invited the creators of a cabaret show about Jelly Roll Morton to perform in the Fresh Air Studios. In his own lifetime, Jelly Roll Morton never received the recognition he deserved, but he's now acknowledged as the first great jazz composer. The performers we'll hear are Vernell Banerese and Gunnar Larson. Banerese is the actor and singer who also created the revues One More Time, Furthermore, and Stagger Lee. He was also the accordion player in the film Pennies from Heaven. Like Jelly Roll Morton, he's from New Orleans. Pianist Morten Gunnar Larsen is from Norway. The narrative within the show was taken directly from Jelly Roll Morton's oral history, as recorded by Alan Lomax for the Library of Congress. Here's Vernell Banerese and Morten Gunnar Larsen.
Anytime you hear anybody playing jazz, what they playing is Jelly Roll. Now, I never got the credit for it, or the cash for that matter, but believe me, it's Jelly Roll. In foreign lands across the sea, they knight a man for bravery. Make him a duke or a count, you see, must be a member of the royalty. Mr. Jelly played a jazzy thing in the temple by the queen and king. All at once he struck upon a harmonic chord. The king said, make Mr. Jelly a lord. He's Mr. Jelly Lord, simply royal at the old keyboard. You should see him strolling down the street. The man's an angel with great big feet. With his melodies, they've made him lord of the ivories. Now at home, as well as abroad, they call him Mr. Jelly Lord. Now, you may be thinking that it might be a bit egotistical of me naming a song after myself. But really, now, anybody who was anybody in the city of New Orleans at that time, they had a song named after him. Usually for heroic reasons, people held high in the minds of their fellow citizens. Not all the time, though. Some people had songs named after them for quite a different reason. A perfect example is a guy I used to play pool with. I couldn't have been no more than 16, 17 years old at the time. Now, he had a song named after him because he was no doubt one of the most heartless men I have ever met. I didn't know it at the time, or else I never would have been playing pool with him. And I certainly would have never beat him at it. But he used to like to play pool with me because he knew that all the piano players at the different bordellos always had plenty cash money. And I was no exception. I'd walk up to the table, throw down my wad and say, "Okay, stand back with your little fives and tens and give my 50s here a chance to breathe." That's what I would say, showing off in front of him. Little did I know that the man I was talking to was Aaron Harris. The man already had 11 killings to his name. Aaron Harris is a bad, bad man. Aaron Harris is a bad, bad man. Now he's the baddest man ever was on this land. I tell you, between people like Aaron Harris and Hoodoo and the racial prejudice that existed in New Orleans at that time, I found that I had to leave the city where I was born and raised and had truly come to love in my heart.
That's wonderful. And that's Vernell Bonnaries and Morten Gunnar Larsen at the piano. And everything that you say in the show is from the Library of Congress recordings.
Yeah, they're all truly Jelly's words and Jelly's music as Jelly intended it to be heard.
Have you tried to get the inflection of his voice when you've been listening to the records?
I'm from New Orleans. I don't have to try that.
Vernell, has doing this Jelly Roll Morton show given you a different perspective at all on New Orleans, where you're from? You know, going back and listening to his stories of coming of age there? And
yes. It's a little frightening for me sometimes in the middle of the show because I look so much like this photograph that they have of Jelly Roll Morton on the wall. And
that's the truth. I mean, you really do look a lot like him.
It's incredible, particularly when I have on the
the apparel.
Pimp. Yes. the old pimp apparel. But there's a continuum for me that I feel in his stories, and hearing his accent is like hearing any uncle of mine talk. And so I feel like I'm carrying the flag on, or the fire like they do in the Olympics, you know, but I feel like I'm just passing it through, and it's been nice.
Well, let's close with another song from the show. Do you know another song for us?
Yes.
Sweet Substitute.
That's a good one. Sweet substitute, sweet substitute. She tells me that she's mine, all mine. Does anything I tell her, love is blind. She's got such loving ways, always got my head in a daze. She's mighty cute, my new recruit, my sweet substitute. Don't want no regulars. My sweet substitute.
We heard an excerpt of a concert recorded last year with singer and actor Vernell Bonnaries and pianist Morten Gunnar Larsen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. With wine, it's the grapes. With beer, it's the grain. Coming up, we continue our conversation about beer with beer expert Michael Jackson. He'll tell us how beer is brewed, he'll rate some of America's best-known brands, and give us some suggestions about what to drink with ethnic food. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Somalia, fugitive faction leader General Adid came out of hiding today to blame the UN for clan violence that has occurred over the last several days. NPR's Michael Scholar reports from Mogadishu.
During an interview with ABC News, General Adid railed against the UN. He accused Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali of committing genocide against the Somalis and claimed the UN was behind Monday's peace march, which erupted into a series of clashes between clans in Mogadishu. Adid has been trying to thwart UN efforts to establish a political system in Somalia. He has returned recent invitations to peace talks, and his faction announced on radio last night that it would not recognize district councils established under UN supervision, but would instead set up its own councils. The militia leader, however, took a softer line toward the U.S., offering to negotiate and welcoming the arrival of U.S. envoy Robert Oakley in the next few days. This is Michael Scholar in Mogadishu.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Democrats have revived an effort to extend jobless benefits to the long-term unemployed. Yesterday, Republican opponents of the bill had voted it down on a procedural measure. Now the Senate has voted 61-39 on a measure to waive the Budget Act in order to get the jobless benefits approved. Since the program ran out October 2nd, some 60,000 people each week have used up their 26 weeks of jobless coverage. President Clinton is expected to sign the bill, extending benefits another 13 weeks once Congress approves it. Canada's Prime Minister-elect Jean Chrétien says that he will keep his campaign promise to make changes in NAFTA. This contrasts with President Clinton's statement that the NAFTA agreement will not be revised. John Halber reports from Toronto.
Throughout his campaign, Jean Chrétien promised that if elected, he would push for a renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. He said NAFTA and the 1989 Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement should be much more clear on the definitions of government subsidy and dumping so that the United States won't be able to invoke either one for protectionist purposes. Today, in his first news conference after Monday's election, Chrétien said he intends to go ahead with the renegotiation and threatened that if Washington refuses to reopen the deal, he would not implement the Canadian side of the legislation for it. Still, some analysts in Canada feel Chrétien is just playing to the fact that NAFTA is unpopular among Canadians, and in the end, he will neither abrogate nor fail to implement the agreement. For National Public Radio, this is John Halber in Toronto.
The government says that orders for durable goods increased last month for the third time in 4 months. The Commerce Department says that durable goods orders were up by 0.7%. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 8 points to close at 3,664 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Pushed on by strong winds, fires in Southern California have burned thousands of acres and more than 100 homes. With winds gusting up to 60 miles an hour, fires have closed schools and roads and tied up traffic. At least 7 major fires are burning north of Los Angeles to the Mexican border. Arson is blamed for the largest blaze that has burned at least 15,000 acres in Ventura County. Several firefighters have been injured, and officials say that 3 Los Angeles City firemen are in critical condition. Asia has already become the home of most of the world's megacities, with urban centers of 10 million or more people. A UN regional conference is now underway in Bangkok, concerned with how governments may cope with rapidly growing urban populations. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
Right now, about one-third of all Asians live in cities. Within 25 years, more than one-half will be urban-based. Already, the infrastructures of many Asian megacities are straining under the population's ever-increasing demands. Bangkok is a prime example. Traffic is in near gridlock. Pollution has made the air dangerous to breathe. There is no citywide sewage treatment center, nor an effective public transportation system. This week's UN conference is trying to encourage governments like Thailand's not to waste any more time. It says if governments want their megacities to remain viable centers of economic progress rather than becoming urban nightmares, they must act now to build and improve appropriate infrastructures. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok.
The conference board says that the nation's economy will expand between 3 to 3.5% through the end of next year. The private business research group says there will also be a modest increase in prices through 1994. The group said that there will be growth in all parts of the economy, with the exception of the federal government. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services, 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Jackson, one of the world's leading experts on beer. After we talk about how beer is brewed, I'm going to ask him to rate some of America's best-known brands. Jackson has a new book called Michael Jackson's Beer Companion. Could you give us a very brief summary of the process of beer making? The kind of simplest version
sure,
that you could come up
with? Well, if you imagine wine is made from fruit, usually grapes. Beer is made from grain, usually barley. You can just stomp on the fruit and the grapes, and that will give you the juices that ferment. You can't quite do that with barley. You have to steep it in water until it begins to sprout, and then dry it to stop it sprouting beyond the optimum point. And when you've done that, you've changed your grain into malt. I mean, everybody's heard of malt, but people often don't know what malt is. Well, what malt is grain that has been partially germinated. You then make an infusion or a decoction of that, which is really like the pressing the grapes. I mean, you're getting the juices, as it were, out of the grains. And that's the point where you add the hops. The hops are the seasoning. The juices of the grains, the malt sugars, would be rather too sweet and cloying on their own. And the hops add dryness and bitterness and flowery flavors, slightly herbal flavors that balance that out. And when you add the hops, you boil all of that together to weld those flavors together. So you now have essentially barley malt juice, which you've boiled up with some flowers off the hop vine. And it's beginning to taste rather like beer. You then ferment that with yeast, and during the fermentation, the liquid creates alcohol and also creates a natural carbonation. And that's it. You've got beer.
How long does that take?
The actual brewing part only takes a day. The fermentation part takes 1 to 2 weeks, and the maturation part takes anything from 1 week to 1 month to 3 months, occasionally longer. It depends what kind of beer you're making. There are beers you can make in 2 to 3 weeks' time, and there are some beers, very few, that take almost a year to make.
Are there certain beers you particularly like to drink when you're in the United States?
Well, I love beers of distinctive character wherever I am and wherever they're made. So when I'm in the US, I'm looking for what's local. Is there something that's local? And if there is something that's local, is it particularly interesting? After that, I'm looking for very assertive beers. I mean, I mentioned the Anchor Steam Brewery, and they make a product called Anchor Liberty Ale, which is just wonderfully dry and hoppy and full of the aroma of Northwestern hops. And that's a terrific style of beer that several other American brewers have made similar examples of that. The Grants Brewery up in Yakima, Washington, right in the heart of hop-growing country, has a beer called IPA, which means India Pale Ale, which is modelled on the style of beer that the British used to send to India, very, very well hopped in order to manage a long, long journey. And that's another of those very, very intense, very hoppy flavours. Every year there's a thing called the Great American Brew Festival in Denver, Colorado, and I was at that a couple of weeks ago, and the Boston Brewing Company, who makes Sam Adams Lager, they had a thing called Triple Bock, which was almost like a sherry. Actually, it was more flavorful than any dry Oloroso sherry I've ever tasted. That was an astonishing beer. The Pike Place Brewery in Seattle occasionally make a beer with oysters in it called Oyster Stout, which is a pretty remarkable beer.
Can I ask you your impressions of a couple of the big commercial beers in the United States?
You can try me.
Okay. Why don't we start with Budweiser? That's the world's biggest selling beer.
It's the world's biggest selling beer, although 90% of its sales are in the United States. So it's a bit like the sort of the World Series.
You know? Right.
And you guys all want to kick Toronto out because they're not Americans. how can it be a World Series then? Budweiser is a very light tasting beer with a little bit of fruitiness in it. I'm not sure that fruitiness is really appropriate to a lager. But that's really all you can say about it. They go to enormous trouble to make Budweiser. The processes they go through, the choice of hops, the number of different hops they use, the whole procedure they have of Beechwood aging, they go to an enormous amount of trouble, but I'm not quite sure why one would go to all of that trouble to produce something so light in taste.
Now, what about Rolling Rock? It's a beer brewed in Pennsylvania.
Rolling Rock has got a great deal of mystique in America, or certainly in certain parts of America, especially in the Northeast. I think there's something funny about the name. There's a mysterious number on the label that nobody can explain what it means, including the brewers. It was a relatively small regional brewery, although it's owned by Labatt's of Canada. But there's nothing special about the beer, really. I mean, it has a sort of touch of new mown hay in the nose, which is a sort of classic lager characteristic of some Bavarian lagers. But there's nothing special about it.
Let me ask you about two of the popular light beers, Miller Lite and Amstel Lite.
Amstel Lite is drier than Miller Lite. I don't see any point whatever, ever in drinking a light beer. If you're worried about your figure, either don't drink beer at all, which is probably the most sensible thing if you're one of these people who puts on a lot of weight from drinking beer, or just drink really good beer but drink less of it. I always think of, when I think of light beer, I have this image in my mind. It always seems to be blonde ladies in airport lounges, who are always drinking light beer, and they're always sitting on a bar stool, wearing a short skirt, crossing their legs, drinking this light beer, and their other hand is swooping down into a bowl of taco chips, which they're eating as fast as they can. And there are as many calories in one of those taco chips as there are in a whole glass of beer.
But light beer does have considerably less calories, doesn't it?
Well, it does have, it has...
Not than tacos, maybe, but than other beer.
It has fewer calories, but it's just not worth drinking. I mean, you'd just be better off to drink the beer you like and not drink so much of it.
What if you're just having one beer?
To me, there's some sort of nonsensical denial here. Either you're drinking beer or you're not. If you're going to drink beer, drink beer. To me, light beer... I don't want to stop people having it if they want it. This is a free country. Let them have it if they want it. But I absolutely...
You're generous.
I absolutely refuse to say anything nice about light beer. In fact, it irritates the hell out of me to see the word light on anything. Either do it or don't do it. You know, if you don't want to eat... if you don't want to eat a plate of fries, don't eat fries. But don't sort of try and get something called light fries. You know, cigarettes that have got light on them. It's just a totally meretricious word.
Michael Jackson is my guest. His new book is called Michael Jackson's Beer Companion. One question about a Chinese beer. A lot of people, when they eat at Chinese restaurants, order Tsingtao.
Well, Tsingtao is quite a nice, light, dry, flowery beer. It has a bit of hop floweriness to it, and you could argue that that goes quite well with Chinese food. I'd still prefer to drink tea with Chinese food, really. But the notion that a beer
Wait, this is Michael Jackson saying he preferred tea with a meal?
Yes, I would prefer tea with Chinese food. And
why?
Because I just think tea goes better with it. You know, that's what you drink with Chinese food in China. Does this notion that you drink lager beer with Indian food, which lager? I mean, which is supposed to be the right one to drink with Indian food? I prefer lassi, really. It's more a more appropriate drink to drink with Indian food. There's a notion out there that if you have ethnic food, you should have the beer of that country. Well, most of those countries aren't really great brewing nations, and beer isn't really a part of their culture, and the food is a part of their culture. There's the odd case where an ethnic beer does go, I think, quite well with the ethnic cuisine. Tsingtao beer from Thailand, there's something about the intensity of hop character of that beer that goes well with those sort of lemongrass flavours that you will find in a lot of Thai food. But these examples are few and far between. I once tried to design for a restaurant, in fact I did design for a couple of restaurants, a beer to drink with Italian food, because there's no real point in just drinking a mainstream Italian beer with Italian food. I mean, if you're not going to drink wine, then you do need a beer that goes with the spicy, rich flavours of Italian food. So I went for a more sort of Vienna-style lager, and I think that works. But on the whole, these beers just don't really exist.
Let me get back to Tsingtao. If beer isn't really a part of Chinese cuisine, why is there a Chinese beer?
The Chinese like to drink beer. It's a very refreshing beer, and they do make a lot of beer. What I'm really just saying is that there's nothing specific to their beer that makes it really go particularly well with their food.
Did another nation bring beer to China, or is it indigenous to the area?
The Germans brought beer to China. The Tsingtao, the town of Tsingtao, is in the province of Shandong, where, you know, Shantung cloth comes from. And that was in a trading relationship, a sort of colonial trading relationship with Germany for a long time. And that's why that beer was introduced there. I've never been to Tsingtao, but I'm told it's very much like some of the cities on the German Baltic. It actually resembles some of those cities architecturally and so forth. The Chinese, I mean, the fermented beverage of China is sake. And even the Japanese will acknowledge that the Chinese introduced sake to Japan.
Do you think that England has different beer drinking habits than the United States does?
The beer drinking habits in every country are a little bit different. In Britain, beer is very sociable. I mean, a huge amount of beer is drunk in pubs. About 80% of beer is drunk in pubs, which is quite the opposite to the situation in the US. So it's being drunk in a sort of as part of a social activity. I mean, the pub in Britain is almost like the church. It's a place where you meet your neighbours and ask how their children are and exchange stories about places you went on vacation or what things people you've seen and so forth. And that's more so in Britain than it is anywhere else. In Germany, in the south of Germany, it's almost as though it's a religious experience, drinking beer. In Belgium, it seems to be a part of gastronomy. I once asked a Czech about Czechoslovakia, where they drink a lot of beer, and of course there we were in the country of Kafka. And he said, oh, it's in drinking beer in Czechoslovakia is a philosophical experience, which I think it probably is. In the US, it's very much associated with the rites of passage into adulthood and with the student years, and much as I think that must be great fun for the students, it's a shame, really, that because it somehow trivializes it. It somehow makes beer a bit of thing that you drank too much of when you were a student. And it associates it with a lot of, I think, rather silly macho. And I think the industry has an awful lot of blame to bear here for the way that it advertises beer in association with sport. I just can't see what beer has to do with sport at all. I don't really see any particular relationship between the two. And I think that by advertising beer as something to do with sport, physical prowess, perhaps sexual prowess as well, the industry is really walking right straight into the arms of the neo-prohibitionists.
How so?
Well, it's sending out all the wrong messages. It's sending out messages that are spurious at best, if not just out and out untrue. And it's really sending out messages that encourage people to drink too much and not to treat beer with respect. And I think people should treat beer with respect, and people should treat alcoholic drinks with respect.
Did you ever go through a period during your youth when beer was the drink of pranks and macho, and when you drank too much?
Yes, in short. I drank much too much throughout the whole of my teenage years, and happily I've survived to tell the tale. But, you know, one shouldn't take these things too lightly. We can't make life so utterly safe that nobody experiences any kind of danger or ever has to use any judgment. And if people never did have to use any judgment, they'd never learn how to, would they? But we should be aware of the dangers inherent in that sort of attitude. And I do think that it is too much the case in the United States, that it's too much the case that beer is rooted in that time of people's lives.
Michael Jackson, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Michael Jackson's new book is called Michael Jackson's Beer Companion. It's published by Running Press. This is Fresh Air. I drink beer, but I never thought about its history or how it was brewed until I first spoke with Michael Jackson and started reading his books. I enjoy beer even more now because I know a little more about it. One of our goals on Fresh Air is to find people who are smart and entertaining and can help us see things a little differently than we did before. That may seem too intangible to put a price on, but believe me, it costs a lot of money to produce Fresh Air. That's why I'm asking you to call with a pledge. To support Fresh Air and all the public radio programs you've come to rely on for entertainment, information, and education. Thanks to everyone who's called with a pledge. This week we're featuring a series on the history of rock and roll. Back in the 1950s, honky-tonking was a mostly male sport, and making the music that accompanied it was also the domain of boys and men. But when Elvis came along, there was no holding back the girls. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a survey of the women who tried to reign as queen in the shadow of the king.
Wild, wild young men like to have a good time. Like to have a good time. Wild, wild boyfriends like to lose their minds. Wild men dig me.
There are some questions that seem to make sense until you ask them. Thinking about the 50s a few weeks ago, somebody asked me, in all innocence, why wasn't there a female Elvis? It would seem to make sense, after all, that if Elvis gave the girls something to scream at, and if screen idols like Marilyn Monroe and Natalie Wood were stirring up the boys' hormones, that a girl rockabilly would be a money-making machine. And it turns out that the answer to the question of a female Elvis is that there was a female Elvis. There were a dozen of them. But you've never heard of them unless you're a real rockabilly fanatic or a country fan. That's where a lot of these young women came from and where the ones who succeeded wound up. My favorite was Wanda Jackson from Maud, Oklahoma, who was Capitol Records' entry into the female Elvis sweepstakes and who, as you can hear, was perfectly capable of rocking out. She recorded lots of straight country just in case the rock and roll fad didn't work out, and that's the path she took until a religious conversion more or less ended her recording career. RCA Records had the original Elvis, so they figured they had the inside track. When pretty teenage Janis Martin showed up in Nashville in 1956, they thought they'd found what they wanted.
They can call you Bill or even Billy, but you're my sweet William and you drive me silly. Oh, Will, Will, you thrill me to my fingertips. William, 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 yum, 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 I love your tasty lips. William, William.
Janis's first record, Will You, William, was a stone flop, and for her next record, they gave her something tested and true.
Hey there, baby, just
course, this was before the record industry learned that rock and roll fans don't buy multiple versions of a song, and Roy Orbison had already milked Ooby Dooby dry. So the last we hear of Janis is this.
Hey, everybody, come on down. The man with the guitar just hit town. Takes off like a rocket, and there he goes. Rocking from his head down to his toes. My boy Elvis, real rock. My boy Elvis, real rock. With his bambling, Elvis sing to me. Heartbreak Hotel, in blue suede shoes. He walks away with all my blues. Take my troubles, take my pain. Load them on that mystery train. My boy Elvis, real rock. My boy Elvis, real rock. With bambling, ooh, Elvis sing to me.
It was her biggest record, but that wasn't saying much. By 1958, Janis Martin's career at RCA was over. Now, if you know much about the history of rock and roll at this time, you're probably saying, sure, you'd expect big labels like Capitol and RCA to blow it. The small independent labels were where the action was. True. And on Cincinnati's Fraternity label, where Lonnie Mack recorded, we find a female rockabilly whose records are pure gold in collector circles today, Sparkle Moore.
You should be labeled with a skull and a crossbones. Oh, you're a jinx to my soul. Yeah, you should be labeled with a skull and a crossbones. Well, you're a jinx to my soul. Oh, yeah. Well, you're a man as to whim, a batter hoping up a prison, cause you look like a child driving everyone wild.
But, as you can hear, Skull and Crossbones had what might be called an eccentric vocal. She smoothed it out some for another record, Rock-a-Bop, but it didn't help much.
You take a rock and a bop when it's really neat, and you put them together with the rock-a-bop beat. Hey, Joe, hey, Joe, you're gonna do the rock-a-bop. Rock-a-bop, you're gonna swing your feet in another rhythm. Ever stop, stop. Rock-a-bop, I said rock-a-bop. Rock-a-bop, I said rock-a-bop with me. Come on and rock-a-bop. Rock-a-bop, come on and rock-a-bop with me. You're gonna swing your feet in another rhythm. Ever stop, stop, rock-a-bop.
Fact was, people weren't buying male rockabillies who sounded like this, although today they're considered the top of the heap. No, the problem with all the female Elvises, including such unlikely personages as Alva Leslie, who combed her short hair back in a fair imitation of the original, but only succeeded in looking like a male impersonator, was that they were girls. And in the 50s, girls were supposed to act in a certain way. It was liberating to see the raw sexuality and frenzied excitement of an Elvis Presley show, but nobody wanted their girlfriend acting that way. And anything less wasn't really rock and roll. It was pop, which is how safer acts like Brenda Lee made it to the charts. In short, nice girls didn't act like that, and bad girls started out with three strikes against them. It would take 20 years for female rock and rollers to get to be an accepted part of the landscape, and by then, Janis Martin, Sparkle Moore, and Wanda Jackson's rocking days had been forgotten.
Ed Ward is currently living and working in Germany. We can't help you find all the songs Ed just played, but we do know that a few years ago, Rhino Records put out a Wanda Jackson CD called Rockin' in the Country.
I've got a guy, I like him fine, but he takes me for granted all of the time. To teach him a lesson, make him mad, I went out on a date with the best friend he had. That made him mad, boy. That made him mad. And he hugged me and he kissed me and he asked me not to do it again. Oh, late last night when I came in, he demanded to know just where I'd been, but I really put him right in his place.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
President Clinton has submitted his health plan to Congress. On the next Fresh Air, what you need to know to understand the healthcare debate. We talk with Mark Roberts of the Harvard School of Public Health and author of the new book, Your Money or Your Life, The Healthcare Crisis Explained. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.